Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
This is we're in the book of Exodus. There are two back-to-back readings scheduled for today. So it's five chapters. It's a lot of chapters, a lot of reading, a lot of discussion. And as usual, I'm sure I won't get to more than half of it. But that's just the way life is. So we're starting out in Exodus chapter 35, starting at verse 1. Moses assembled the entire assembly, the children of Israel, and said to them, "These are the things the Lord commanded to do them. On 6 days work may be done, but the seventh day should be holy for you, a day of complete rest for the Lord. Whoever does work on it shall be put to death. You shall not kindle a fire in any of your dwellings on the Sabbath day." Moses said to the entire assembly of the children of Israel, saying, "This is the word the Lord has commanded, saying, take from yourselves a portion for the Lord. Everyone whose heart motivates him shall bring it. As the gift for the Lord, gold, silver, copper, turquoise, purple, and scarlet wool, linen, and goat hair, red dyed ram skins, takash skins, and acacia wood, oil for illumination, spices for the anointment oil, and the aromatic incense, Shoham stones and stones for settings, for the ephod and the breastplate. Every wise-hearted person among you shall come and make everything the Lord has commanded. The tabernacle, its tent, and its cover, its hooks, its planks, its bars, its pillars, and its sockets. The ark and its staves, the cover, the partition curtain, the table and its staves, and all its utensils, and the showbread, the menorah of illumination, its utensils and its lamps, and oil for the illumination, the incense altar and its staves, the anointment oil, and the incense spices, and the entrance screen for the entrance of the tabernacle, the burnt offering altar and the netting for it, its staves and all its utensils, the laver and its base, the curtains of the courtyard, its pillars and its sockets, and the screen of the gate of the courtyard, the pegs of the tabernacle, the pegs of the courtyard, and their cord, the knit vestments to serve in the sanctuary, the sacred vestments for Aaron the Cohen, and the vestments for his sons to minister. The entire assembly of the children of Israel left Moses' presence. Every man whose heart inspired him came, and everyone whose spirit motivated him brought the portion of the Lord for the work of the tent of meeting, for all its labor, and for all the sacred vestments. The men came with the women, everyone whose heart motivated him, brought bracelets, nose rings, rings, body ornaments, all sorts of gold ornaments, every man who raised up an offering of gold to the Lord. Every man with whom was found turquoise, purple, and scarlet wool, linen and goat hair, dyed ram skins, and Takish skins brought them. Every man who separated a portion of silver or copper brought it as a portion for the Lord. And everyone with whom there was acacia wood for any work of the labor brought it. Every wise-hearted woman spun with her hands, and they brought the spun yarn of turquoise, purple, and scarlet wool, and the linen. And all the women whose hearts inspired them with wisdom spun the goat hair. The leaders brought the Shoham stones and the stones for the settings, the ephod and the breastplate, the spice and the oil for illumination and the anointment oil and the incense spices. Every man and woman whose heart motivated them to bring for any of the work the Lord had commanded to make through Moses, the children of Israel brought a free-willed offering to the Lord. Moses said to the children of Israel, "See, the Lord has proclaimed by name Bezaleel, son of Uri, son of Hur, the tribe of Judah. He filled him with godly spirit and with wisdom, insight and knowledge, with every craft, to weave designs, to work with gold, silver, and copper, for stone cutting, for settings, and wood carving, to perform every craft of design. He gave him the ability to teach him, and Eliab, son of Ahimash, of the tribe of Dan. He filled them with a wise heart to do every craft of the carver, weaver of designs, and embroiderer, with the turquoise, purple, and scarlet wool, and the linen, and the weaver, the artisans of every craft, and makers of designs. Chapter 36. Bezaleel shall carry out with Aholiab and every wise-hearted man within whom the Lord has endowed wisdom and insight to know and to do all the work, the labor of the sanctuary. Everything the Lord had commanded, Moses summoned Bezaleel and Aholiab and every wise-hearted man whose heart the Lord had endowed with wisdom. Everyone's heart inspired him to approach to the work to do it. From Moses' presence, they took the entire gift Israel had brought for the work, for the labor of the sanctuary to do it. But they continued to bring him free-will gifts morning after morning. All the wise-hearted people came, those performing the sacred work, each of them from his work that they were doing. And they said to Moses as follows, "The people are bringing more than enough for the labor of the work the Lord has commanded to perform." Moses commanded, they proclaimed throughout the camp, saying, "Man and woman shall not do more work toward the gift of the sanctuary." And the people were restrained from bringing. But the work had been enough for all the work to do it, and there was extra. The wise-hearted among those doing the work made the tabernacle with 10 curtains of linen, twisted with turquoise, purple, and scarlet wool. They made them with a woven design of cherub. The length of each curtain was 28 cubits, and the width of each curtain was 4 cubits, the same measure for all the curtains. He attached 5 curtains to one another, and 5 curtains he attached to one another. He made loops of turquoise wool on the edge of a single curtain at the end of one set, so he did at the edge of the outermost curtain on the second set. He made 50 loops on the one curtain and 50 loops at the end of the other curtain on the second set, loops corresponding to one another. He made 50 clasps of gold and attached the curtains to one another with the clasps, so the tabernacle became one. He made curtains of goat hair for the tent over the tabernacle. He made them 11 curtains. The length of each curtain was 30 cubits, and the width of each curtain was 4 cubits. The same measure for the 11 curtains. He attached 5 curtains separately and 6 curtains separately. He made 50 loops on the edge of the outermost curtain of the set and 50 loops on the edge of the curtain of the second set. He made 50 clasps of copper to attach the tent so it would become one. He made a cover for the tent of red dyed ram skins and a cover of Takish hides on top. He made the planks for the tabernacle of acacia wood, standing erect. 10 cubits was the height of the plank, and a cubit and a half its width of each plank. Each plank shall have 2 tenons parallel to one another. So he did for all the planks the tabernacle. He made the planks for the tabernacle 20 planks for the south side. He made 40 silver sockets under the 20 planks, 2 sockets under one plank for its 2 tenons, and 2 sockets on the next plank for its 2 tenons. And for the second wall, the tabernacle, its north side, he made 20 planks. There are 40 sockets of silver, 2 sockets under one plank, and 2 sockets under the next plank. For the back of the tabernacle, on the west side, he made 6 planks. He made 2 planks for the corners of the tabernacle in the back. They were all even at the bottom, and together they were matching at the top, to a single ring. So did he do to them both, at the 2 corners. There were 8 planks and their silver sockets, 16 sockets and 2 sockets and 2 sockets under each plank. He made bars of acacia wood, 5 for the planks of one side of the tabernacle, and 5 bars of planks the second side of the tabernacle. 5 bars of planks the tabernacle the back. On the west, he made the middle bar to extend within the planks from end to end. He covered the planks with gold. They made their rings of gold as housings, bars. He covered the bars with gold. He made the partition of turquoise, purple, and scarlet wool and linen twisted. He made it with a woven design of cherub. He made it four pillars of acacia wood and plated them with gold. Their hooks were gold. He cast for them four sockets of silver. For the entrance of the tent, he made a screen of turquoise, purple, and scarlet wool, and linen, twisted, work of an embroiderer. Its pillars were five, with their hooks. He plated their tops and their bands with gold, and their sockets were five of copper. Chapter 37. Bezaleel made the ark of acacia wood, 2.5 cubits its length, 1.5 cubits its width, 1.5 cubits its height. He covered it with pure gold within and without, and he made it for a gold crown all around. He cast for them four rings of gold on its four corners, 2 rings on one side and 2 rings on the second side. He made staves of acacia wood and covered them with gold. He inserted the staves in the rings on the sides of the ark to carry the ark. He made a cover of pure gold, 2.5 cubits its length, and 1.5 cubits its width. He made 2 cherubs of gold. Hammered out did he make them. The 2 ends of the cover, 1 cherub from the end at one side and 1 cherub at the end of the other side. From the cover did he make the cherubs from its 2 ends. The cherubs were with wings spread upward, sheltering the cover with their wings, and their faces toward one another, toward the cover with the faces of the cherubs. He made a table of acacia wood, 2 cubits its length, 1 cubit its width, 1.5 cubits its height. He covered with pure gold and made for it a gold crown all around. He made for it molding of 1 hand breadth all around. He made a gold crown for its molding all around. He cast it for 4 rings of gold and placed the rings on the 4 corners of its 4 legs. The rings were opposite the molding as housings for staves to carry the table. He made the staves of acacia wood and covered them with gold to carry the table. He made the utensils that were on the table, its dishes, its spoons, its pillars, its shelving tubes, with which it was covered, of pure gold. He made the menorah of pure gold, hammered out did he make it. The menorah, its base, its shaft, its cups, its knobs, its flowers, were from it. 6 branches emerged from its sides. 3 branches from of the menorah from its side, and 3 branches of the menorah from its second side. 3 cups engraved like almonds on 1 branch, a knob and a flower, and 3 cups engraved like almonds, a knob and a flower on the next branch. So he did for the 6 branches that emerged from the menorah. And on the menorah were 4 cups engraved like almonds, its knob and its blossoms. A cup was under 2 branches from it, a knob was under 2 branches from it, and a knob was under 2 branches from it. For the 6 branches emerging from it, their knobs and branches were all of it, all of a single hammered piece of pure gold. He made its lamps 7, its tongs and spoons of pure gold, all of a talent of pure gold did he make it, and all its utensils. He made the incense altar of acacia wood, 1 cubit its length, 1 cubit its width, square, 2 cubits its height. From it were its horns. He covered it with pure gold, its roof and its walls, all around its horns. And he made for it a gold crown all around. He made for it 2 gold rings under its crown on its 2 corner edges on 2 sides, as housings for staves with which to carry it. He made the staves of acacia wood and covered them with gold. He made the anointment oil holy, and the incense spices pure, a perfumer's handiwork. Chapter 38. He made the burnt offering altar of acacia wood, 5 cubits its length and 5 cubits its width, square, 3 cubits its height. He made its horns on its 4 corners from where its horns, and he covered it with copper. He made all the utensils of the altar, the pots, the shovels, the basins, the forks, and the fire pans. He made all its utensils of copper. He made for the altar a netting of copper meshwork below its surrounding border, downwards until its midpoint. He cast 4 rings on the 4 edges of the copper netting as housings for staves. He made the staves of acacia wood and covered them with copper. He inserted the staves in the rings on the sides of the altar with which to carry it. Hollow out of boards did he make it. He made the laver of copper and its base of copper from the mirrors of the legions who massed the entrance to the tent of meeting. He made the courtyard on the south side, the lace hangings of the courtyard of twisted linen, 100 cubits. Their pillars 20, and their sockets 20 of copper, hooks of the pillars and their bands of silver. On the north side, 100 cubits, their pillars, 20 in their sockets, 20 of copper, the hooks of the pillars and their bands of silver. On the west side, lace hangings of 50 cubits, their pillars 10 and their sockets 10, the hooks of the pillars and their sockets, bands made of silver. On the eastern side, 50 cubits, 15-cubit lace hangings at the shoulder, their pillars were 3 and their sockets 3, at the second shoulder. On either side of the gate of the courtyard, there are 15-cubit lace hangings. Their pillars, 3, and their sockets, 3. All the lace hangings, the courtyard, all around, were of twisted linen. The sockets of the pillars were copper. The hooks of the pillars and their bands were silver. The plating of the tops were silver. They were banded with silver, all the pillars of the courtyard. The screen of the gate of the courtyard was embroider's work of turquoise, purple, and scarlet wool and twisted linen, 20 cubits in length and height. In width, it was 5 cubits, corresponding to the lace hangings of the courtyard. Their pillars, 4, their sockets, 4, of copper, their hooks, silver, and the plating of their tops and their bands, silver. All the pegs, the tabernacle, and the courtyard all around were copper. These are the reckonings of the tabernacle of testimony, which were reckoned at Moses' bidding. The labor of the Levites was under the authority of Itamar, son of Aaron the Kohen. Bezaleel, son of Uri, son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah, did everything the Lord had commanded Moses. With him was Eliab, son of Ahimash, of the tribe of Dan, a carver, weaver, and embroiderer with turquoise, purple, scarlet wool, and with linen. All the gold was used for this work, for all the holy work, offered up gold was 29 talents and 730 shekels in the sacred shekel. The silver of the community was 100 talents, 1,775 shekels in the sacred shekel. A beka for every head, a half shekel in the sacred shekel for everyone who passed through the census takers, from 20 years of age and up, for the 603,550. The 100 talents of silver were cast up to the sockets of the sanctuary and the sockets of partition, 100 sockets for 100 talents, 1 talent per socket. And from 1,775, he made hooks for the pillars, covered their tops, and banded them. The offered up copper was 70 talents and 2,400 shekels. With it, he made the sockets of the entrance, the tent of meeting, the copper altar, the copper meshwork that was on it, and all the vessels, the altar, the sockets of the courtyard all around, the sockets of the gate of the courtyard, all the pegs of the tabernacle, and all the pegs of the courtyard all around. Chapter 39. For the turquoise, purple, and scarlet wool, they made knit vestments to serve the sanctuary. They made the holy vestments for Aaron, as the Lord had commanded Moses. He made the ephod of gold, turquoise, purple, and scarlet wool, and twisted linen. They hammered out the thin sheets of gold and cut threads to work the weaver's craft into the turquoise, into the purple, into the scarlet wool, and into the linen. They made attached shoulder straps for it, attached to its two ends. The belt with which it was emplaced, which was on it, was made of it of the same workmanship, of gold, turquoise, purple, and scarlet wool, and twist and linen. They twisted, as the Lord had commanded Moses. They made the shoham stones, encircled with gold settings, engraved like the engraving of a signet ring, according to the names of the sons of Israel. He placed them on the shoulder straps of the ephod, as remembrance stones for the sons of Israel, as the Lord had commanded Moses. He made the breastplate of a weaver's craft, like the workmanship of the ephod of gold, turquoise, purple, and scarlet wool, and linen twisted. It was square. Folded over did they make it, the breastplate. Its length was half a cubit, its width half a cubit, folded over. They filled it with four rows of stones, a row of odem, pitad, barquettes, one row. The second row, nofech, safir, yashalon. The third row, leshem, shavoh, and achmala, in their mountings. The stones were according to the names of the sons of Israel, 12 according to their names, like the engraving of a signet ring, each man according to his name for the 12 tribes. For the breastplate, they made chains at the edges, a braided craftsmanship of pure gold. They made two gold settings and two gold rings, and they placed the two rings on the two ends of the breastplate. They placed the two gold ropes on the two rings on the ends of the breastplate. The two ends of the ropes they placed on the two settings and placed them on the shoulder straps of the ephod toward its front. They made two gold rings and placed them on the two ends of the breastplate at its edge, which on the inner side toward the ephod. They made two gold rings and placed them at the bottom of the ephod. Bottom of the shoulder straps toward the front, opposite seam above the belt of the ephod. They attached the breastplate from its rings to the rings of the ephod with a turquoise wool cord, so that it would remain above the belt of the ephod, and the breastplate would not be loosened from above the ephod, as the Lord commanded Moses. They made the robe of the ephod of a weaver's craft entirely of turquoise wool. Its head opening was folded over with inside it, like the opening of a coat of mail. Its opening had a border all around, so that it would not tear. They made belts of pure gold. Hold on a minute. I read that wrong. On the robe. The robe's hem, they made pomegranates of turquoise, purple, and scarlet wool twisted. They made bells of pure gold. They placed the bells amid the pomegranates on the hem of the robe all around. Amid the pomegranates, there was a bell and a pomegranate, a bell and a pomegranate, all the way in the hem of the robe all around. To minister as the Lord commanded Moses. They made the tunics of linen, a weaver's craft, for Aaron and his sons, and a turban of linen, the splendid headdress of linen, and linen breeches of twisted linen. The sash of twisted linen, turquoise, purple, and scarlet wool of an embroider's work, as the Lord commanded Moses. They made the head plate, the holy crown of pure gold. They inscribed on it with the scribe of a signet ring, saying, Holy to the Lord. They placed on it a cord of turquoise wool to pull over the turban from above, as the Lord had commanded Moses. All the work, the tabernacle, the tent of meeting, was completed, and the children of Israel had done everything the Lord had commanded Moses, so they did. They brought the tabernacle to Moses, the tent and all its utensils, its hooks, its planks, its bars, its pillars, its sockets, the cover of red-dyed ram hides, the cover of Tekoish skins, and the partition curtain, the ark of the testimony, its staves and the cover, the table and all its utensils and the showbread, the pure menorah, its lamps, the lamps of the prescribed order, and its all the utensils and the oil of illumination, the gold altar, the anointment oil, and the incense spices, the partition of the entrance of the tent. There's copper altar, its copper meshwork, its staves and all its utensils, the laver and its base, the curtains of the courtyard, its pillars and its sockets, the partition of the gate of the courtyard, its ropes and its pegs, and all the utensils for the service of the tabernacle, the tent of meeting. All the knitted vestments to serve in the sanctuary, the sacred vestments of Aaron and the Cohen, and the vestments to his sons to minister. Like everything the Lord had commanded Moses, so did the children of Israel perform all the labor. Moses saw the entire work, and behold, they had done it as the Lord had commanded, so they had done it. And Moses blessed them. Chapter 40. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, On the day of the first new moon, on the first of the month, you shall erect the tabernacle of the tent of meeting. There you shall place the ark of testimony and screen the ark with the partition. You shall bring the table and prepare its setting. Bring the menorah and kindle the flames. You shall place the gold altar for incense in front of the Ark of Testimony, and in place the curtain of the entrance of the tabernacle. You shall place the burnt offering altar in front of the entrance of the tabernacle, the tent of meeting. You shall place the laver between the tent of meeting and the altar. You shall put water there. You shall emplace the courtyard all around, and emplace the curtain at the edge, at the gate, of the courtyard. You shall take the anointment oil and anoint the tabernacle and everything that is in it. Sanctify it and all its utensils, and it shall become holy. You shall anoint the burnt offering altar and all its utensils. You shall sanctify the altar, and the altar shall become holy of holies. You shall anoint the laver and its stand and sanctify it. You shall bring Aaron and his sons near the entrance of the tent of meeting and immerse them in water. You shall dress Aaron in the sacred vestments and anoint him. You shall sanctify him and he shall minister to me. And his sons you shall bring near and dress them in tunics. You shall anoint them as you had anointed their father and they shall minister to me. And so it shall be that their anointment shall be for an eternal priesthood for their generations. Moses did according to everything the Lord had commanded him to do. So he did. It was in the first month, the second year of the first month, the tabernacle was erected. Moses erected the tabernacle. He put down its sockets and placed its planks and inserted its bars, erected its pillars. He spread the tent over the tabernacle and put the cover of the tent on it from above. And the Lord commanded Moses. He took and placed the testimony into the ark and inserted the staves on the ark. He placed the cover on the ark from above. He brought the ark into the tabernacle and emplaced the partition sheltering the ark of the testimony as the Lord had commanded Moses. He put the table in the tent of meeting on the north side of the tabernacle, outside the partition. He prepared it on the setting of bread before the Lord as the Lord had commanded Moses. He placed the menorah in the tent of meeting opposite the table on the south side of the tabernacle. He kindled the flames for the Lord as the Lord had commanded Moses. He placed the gold altar in the tent of meeting in front of the partition. Upon it he caused incense spice to go up in smoke, as the Lord had commanded Moses. He emplaced the curtain at the entrance of the tabernacle. He placed the burnt offering altar at the entrance of the tent of meeting. He brought upon it the elevation offering and the meal offering, as the Lord had commanded Moses. He emplaced the laver between the tent of meeting and the altar. There he put water for washing. Moses, Aaron, and his sons washed their hands and feet from it. When they came to the tent of meeting, and when they approached the altar, they would wash, as the Lord had commanded Moses. He erected the courtyard all around the tabernacle and the altar, and he emplaced the curtain of the gate to the courtyard. So Moses completed the work. The cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Moses could not enter the tent of meeting, for the cloud rested upon it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. When the cloud was raised up upon the tabernacle, the children of Israel would embark on all their journeys. If the cloud did not rise up, they would not embark until the day it rose up. For the cloud of the Lord would be on the tabernacle by day, and a fire would be on it at night, before the eyes of all the house of Israel throughout their journeys. It's a lot of reading. Yeah, it's a lot of reading. Hold on a minute.
I kind of get mixed up a little bit. This is the tabernacle that they wandered in the desert with it for 40 years, right?
Yes.
Okay. Now, some of those pieces that they made, the gold pieces in the ark, they were to continue and went on into the real temple that Solomon built later. Is that right?
Solomon did not reuse anything except the ark itself and the gold altar. The altar of incense. The other items he rebuilt. He built new ones.
Okay.
He rebuilt a new menorah. He built a new table. He built a massive laver of a bathtub / pool you could swim in for washing and cleaning. And he made everything, the entire temple that he built, was either 2 or 3 times bigger in every dimension. Yes.
Excuse me. A couple of things I thought was interesting about this was that first of all, we kind of think that Moses was the one who designed all this, but it actually just came into the mind of the builders, apparently.
It is interesting that God shows Moses the image, because when God's going to Moses and walking him through it, as you have seen, as you saw, well, Moses can only relate so much of what he sees to the people that actually build it. It is truly an artist's work. Moses was not an artist. All the designs, one of the ideas.
Open to interpretation.
Yeah, it would have looked, it could have been something like that. There would have been, on this, the drawings God here, there would have been there would be a cherub on all the panels in the embroidered work all the way around it as well. And cherub are one or two-headed creatures, angels. It depends, depending on your perspective, whether it's one or two, your opinion. Depending on the application, sometimes they had one, sometimes they had two. In Ezekiel's time, cherub have two, one's head of a man, head of a lion, one on each side. It has its reasons. But cherub just basically means a representation of an angelic creature. It's not a real creature. It represents something that is supposed to be real, an angel spirit. So it would have been all around the tabernacle, on the outside courtyard as well as the inside. They would have different colors and different designs of which one they were doing. We'll discuss that briefly later on.
We have this image of the Israelites in Egypt.
Right.
And yet
right.
They had so much gold jewelry that they were overwhelming Moses when they brought it to build a tabernacle.
That's true. When they plundered Egypt, remember when they left Egypt, God's, excuse me, I'm battling a cold here. God told them before they left to ask and borrow from all their neighbors. And Egyptians were freely, because they were afraid of them, say, here, take it, because they've gone through the first 9 plagues by this time. And say, okay, we've had enough, and some know about the 10th plague, some don't. But they're all, borrow it, and God says, you will plunder Egypt. So they have lots and lots of gold. Mind you, these people were slaves. They didn't have a whole lot to start with. But now they have a whole bunch of Egypt's gold. And they may have also gotten a few things from the army that Egypt went and got drowned in the Red Sea. I'm not sure. They obviously picked up, they saw the Egyptians dead by the seashore. They may have picked up some armament at the same time. But they plundered Egypt for a lot of property, a lot of things. At the same time, the stuff is not free. It's still expensive. So it takes a lot of effort to gather all these items which they were going to offer. And also remember that this is after the golden calf incident. They already drank a percentage of their wealth, because the golden calf, when they did that, Moses ground it up and mixed it with water, made them drink the water. So some of it's in their bellies and probably expelled out, but I assume they didn't harvest that. But the rest of it they harvest as far as gold, jewelry, and things of that nature, they would have used and harvested. His hand was up. Yes, Deborah.
Oh, okay. When I was looking this out, there's in Ezekiel 20:13, and it was because of the stones. It says, thou hast been in Eden, the garden of God, every precious stone, thy covering, the sardis, topaz, and goes through all the emeralds and all the... And so I was wondering how that, the way that he talks to Satan in Ezekiel and Isaiah, and he says, you know, all these things were in you in the world. And I was wondering... the whole earth was, he said, yeah, you know, when the day I created you, all these stones were in you, all these things. Maybe Hasatan was the earth, you know? And I thought, because he's talking all the time about how the commerce and all this. And, you know, the earth is filled with all these stones and goods and ores, and we use them. And he says, you went back and forth, and your heart was, blown up, and I thought, God, that sounds so strange. And then, when they're making the breastplate, all these stones, and I want to know if you know anything or suspect anything, the correlation between the archangel and these precious stones and all this stuff.
Appearance.
I felt like, when I was seeing this, I felt like, wow, The knowledge that we were taught over the centuries has been deteriorated, and some of it is kept precious because the Jewish people feel very guarded over a lot of the knowledge, so they pass it to their own generation to generation. And so the stones and the correlation, and I thought, wow, the earth is filled with all of these things. And so what is, what's this about? Because he says in the end, he's going to burn it up. And we know that at the end days, the whole earth is going to burn up. So I thought, wow, there's something here. And I couldn't put my finger on it, but I know it's something. But I was studying, so, and it started to get real long. But
everything that you see in the tabernacle, all the vestments, all the parts, all the pieces, every component there is, its shape, its design, are all designed for beauty. and glory and splendor. That was its objective, to make things look very attractive and very appealing and very interesting, to catch your eye. That was its goal, and it does a very good job. Note, when you've heard the Hasatan or various other angels, some of them, their function was for beauty. That was their job. That's your task, go do it. And that was what, hence, these items we attract to. Naturally, most humans know that gold is pretty. We like gold because it's pretty. Like certain stones because they're pretty. The appearance is what attracts you. That was the objective. God wanted it to appear pretty. He wanted it to appear attractive. Because when things are here attractive, what do you do to them? You look. You look at it. Say, wow, look at that. That's the goal. Wow, look at that. What is it? Oh, can I touch it? No. Why not? Let's discuss it. We'll explain why not. And they go through a process. Because the whole idea, when we have ideas or opinions or beliefs about God, His goal is for us to go to Him, ask for help, prayers, whatever makes a difference. If we have this image in our head that He's an overbearing meanie, we run away. On the other hand, if we have the image in our head that He's beautiful, powerful, and great strength, we run toward. So we, as humans, we tend to attract ourselves to pretty things, because we're human. Rats do too. That's different. We're not rats, but pretty things. We're supposed to attract ourselves to things that are beautiful. Well, God wants us to associate Him as an attractive thing, to attract toward Him. Each of the angels are designed that way as well in their appearance. When they appear, these bright lights, or very bright, intense things. But when they're designed to gather your attention to look at it, because you can't learn anything unless you're looking at whatever you're supposed to learn. Make sense? Everything's designed for beauty, to attract our attention. Yes?
If the high priest's garments had all that gold, how come he didn't collapse during one of his services?
Well, it's not saying the gold clasps were like, you know, an inch and a half in diameter of solid bands of gold all around. It wasn't that big. They're relatively thin, strong enough to do the job. Note, what is it carrying? It's carrying an apron. Seriously, how heavy are aprons? They're not. So how much gold do you need to carry as a clasp an apron? A gold chain around somebody's neck could do that. And the apron has little stone settings on it. The same idea. They're not that heavy. And they're not massive stones the size of half-head rocks. They're relatively small, because it only has a little space this big to fit in. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 12, and little gold settings. They're not that heavy. So yes, it could be heavy, but it doesn't have to be. It's mostly fabric. And the gold is intertwined in the braid. One of the scriptures points out, when they were doing the ephod, the gold is cut into very, very thin strips, and woven inside the wool and inside the linen, in like a braid, or we would think of a braid or crochet type of design, or a knit design. So woven inside of it, it's a thin, thin strip on most of the decorative items. And most of the other things are heavier clasps that the priest wears are not massive hunks of metal. They're thin to do the job. And the necklace would be, women wear necklaces and earrings that are relatively big and heavy in some cases, but if you look at them closely, they really aren't that heavy necessarily. They don't have to be heavy to be pretty. They can be relatively small and lightweight and still do the job. Yes?
I was just going to ask two things. Well, one, I was going to ask what the English translation of those two were. And the second thing is what you were talking about just now. It's, you know, if you take our young men in the military and the weight that they carry in a backpack, plus their ornaments,
like,
and around
their
waist. And my point is, as it's made correctly to distribute its weight, you know, we can pack a lot of weight and not even notice it.
You're right. If it's distributed around your body, your body can carry a whole lot of weight. These two words are assembly and account. Vaikel and Piduke, assembly and account. Any questions or comments? Yes. Okay.
Verse 35, it says Moses could not enter the tent of meeting. Is there a reason?
Let's see here. Hold on. Let me go back to verse. Sorry, what chapter verse was that? Verse 40 of what chapter?
35.
Let's see here. Verse 40 of 35. I don't have a verse 40 of 35.
Chapter 40.
Oh, chapter 40. I apologize. So let's see. Verse 40 of 35. Yes. It says, Moses could not enter the tent of meeting, for the cloud rested upon it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. your question about that, or what? Why couldn't he?
Yeah.
Oh, two things. First of all, the presence of the Lord is massive cloud. It's a very dark colored cloud, as in storm clouds, dark gray, dark, intense dark. That's what it's supposed to look like, as Solomon describes what it looks like. It's a very dark looking cloud. So when you fill it up, you fill up this room or this building, this tabernacle, all filled with this darkness, can you see where you're going? No. Can you accidentally walk in the wrong spot? Uh-huh. There's a man, what was his name? Uziel? I forgot. Who tried to sell the ark when the ark was traveling along on the cart, and it struck him dead. This is back in David's time. You don't accidentally do things. And when you can't see, you don't do them. So that's one basic fundamental reason. It's too dark. You can't go into it. Second of all, you're relatively scared of this image. Unless you're called in to the cloud, you don't go. God may come in a cloud, and God called Moses up the mountain all the time. Come up, come up, come up. But when God didn't call him, did Moses go up? No, he didn't. He stayed out of this cloud, this presence, lest God called him. So God did not call Moses into the tabernacle when God came. Moses was pushed out. Why would that be? Who is the high priest? Aaron. Is Moses the high priest? No. So who is still permitted to go in if for some reason they have to? The high priest. The Aaron is supposed to, should theoretically be able to go in. He goes in the Holy of Holy areas and things of that nature as well. So Aaron can go in. However, this massive cloud is there hanging out. Did Aaron get called to go in? No. So at that moment in time, no one was called to go into this dark black cloud. So what do? Get out. Get out. Yeah, it's his house. This is where he dwells. You don't go into a stranger's house or somebody else's house without being invited, do you? So you wait to get invited. Particularly if the stranger happens to be God, who can strike you long distance away and make you miserable. So the point is, you wait until you're invited in. Make sense? He only allows you to get in certain times. And half the book of Leviticus is dedicated to how you get back in. Yes, Deborah.
I was just wondering, it says, and they ministered to the Lord. So I'm wondering, what could they possibly minister to the Lord? So, yeah, I wanted to know what you thought. When they said
the term minister?
They ministered to the Lord.
Yeah.
I mean, what would they minister to him?
Everything they were assigned to do.
So they'd say, yes, Father, we built hammered it out. So ministering
God gave us an assignment, a job to each of the people. So Aaron had his job as high priest. His sons had their jobs also. What were their jobs? Their jobs were to bring the people to God. That was their function. There was a natural separation between human beings and God. It's called flesh. We're built that way. Well, the priest's job is to break down the separator between God and man. That's how you serve God as a priest. You're not washing his feet and cleaning his clothing like a servant, a slave. God doesn't need his feet washed or his clothing cleaned. His service is, go do the work I assigned you to do, which is take care of all the people you're assigned to go take care of, and go do it properly, no mistakes. Make sense? So their job to serve in serving God, that's the way which they minister to him, and that they take care of exactly the job they were assigned to do and do it the way they wanted it done. Yes?
Obviously, those items were treasured by all those people, and probably for generations and generations. Whatever happened to all those items?
Good question. Some got repurposed, recycled, so to speak, in that Solomon repurposed a lot of them. He took them when he had the opportunity and rebuilt new ones. Scrapped out or disposed of the ones that were of worn out or no longer use. Note, how long does wood last? Depends what kind of wood it is. You might get 100 years out of a wood. Sometimes really like nice woods, you protect well, you get even 200 or 300 years out of it. Well, how many years is it from the tabernacle before Solomon's time? About 400 to 500 years. Does wood last that long? Not generally. So eventually they have to get replaced and rebuilt as time goes on, because they only last so long. The exception being the ark itself. Why would the ark itself be the exception? because it was plated with gold inside and out. So the elements cannot touch it in any way. It's completely protected in all sides. We don't have to, I'm not going to argue where it went now. The altars, however, they exposed to fire all the time. There's the incense fire and the main altar fire. You get heat going all the time. Guess what happens to the wood underneath? Well, it starts to decompose and starts to get really hot and burn up. So even though it's coated with the metal, it still gets damaged. So those get replaced as time goes on. It's a continuous replacement cycle as years go by. Yes.
Then how come on the ark, how come the metal, the gold didn't droop because it's a very soft metal?
Oh, on the incense altar? The incense altar is...
Or any gold...
Right, the incense altar is the only one that had fire. With the menorah did too. The fire on the incense altar was incense in particular. That is not super hot. There are coals in it, but it's not super hot as far as you're not trying to heat up the actual main frame of it. There is a little netting, so to speak, in the middle of all of them that hold most of your components, your heat components. The main offering altar where the animals are offered, that's a huge fire. That's not just coals, it's actually a fire, and that actually gets things very hot. And copper is a heavy, very good conductor of heat, like many other metals all too. And that will actually distribute out to the frame and get it hot, overheat the wood over time. Now note, this is made from acacia wood, all of it's acacia wood. That's a tree in Africa, but it's considered in what they call an incorruptible tree, much like we think of like redwood or cedar wood in our own, you know, culture where we live here. It lasts a very long time, but not forever. It has its lifespan, but it does last a while. So designed to handle heat, designed to handle the elements for a long period of time, but eventually they do get wiped out. The incense altar, the gold one, is not super hot, and there is no indication they have 24 karat gold there. I don't know what kind of gold they had. It's probably good, but I don't know how pure it was. But either way, the netting itself carries most of the weight and most of the heat, and it's not super hot. On the incense altar, the gold one, it's not super hot. The other altar is very hot. The menorah is also gold. However, it has an oil basin, an oil trough. When you go through your physics classes or your physics instruction, you can actually boil or burn, take a styrofoam cup, you know, melts it quick, right, and sit it on a hot plate of fire and not burn up if you have water inside. Because water takes a lot of the heat away and prevents the cup from burning. So you can do a lot of things with liquids that you can't do with other things. So even though the gold menorah should melt too, because it has active fire on it, the oil itself prevents the act of actually melting it, because the oil keeps it down in temperature. Does that make sense? Any questions? Yes.
I was just wondering, why do you think the Lord always seems to use a cloud when he makes an appearance?
Why do we think he uses a cloud? I'll think about that. It has to do with not being able to see him. But as far as whether he could have used other techniques, he uses a fire in the evening time when it's dark, so you can see him, but not just see him, but see like this place for him. When it comes to when the leaders go up to the mountain to eat with God for a period of time, and God shows himself to him, they describe this blue ground he's standing on, this like light type of thing to come, but basically it's a blue ground, the sapphire stone ground. They describe what that looks like. And the intent is, even though God's showing himself, per se, he's not actually showing him what he looks like, but just a place where he's hanging out at. So it has to do with more of where he's hanging out he wants you to see, not necessarily him. So the cloud he's using, that he hangs out in the cloud, and he hangs out in the fire, but not as if those are actually his physical items. I think most likely, look up. What's up there? We see blue sky and we see clouds. Now, before the invention of airplanes, could we touch those? Could we access them? Could we do anything with them? No, we can't. They're beyond our reach. So they're supposed to represent things that are above or greater than we are that we cannot do anything with. Well, now we have airplanes, we can fly in them. We can't do much with it, just fly past. But it still exists. We have a little more feel of what they are. But there's still things which you cannot access. You cannot touch or grab. So it's probably why he chose those items in particular. There could be other reasons too, which I'd have to think about and analyze to know for certain. But yes.
Also, Paul said that cloud and that fire was Christ.
Right. But first, why those two items? I couldn't know why he chose the two items.
The cloud is mysterious. You can't see what's going on in there. And like you said, you don't want to go in.
To veil or to conceal one's eyes, to not see it. Because you see the place of him, but not actually him, which makes sense. There could be other reasons. I don't know all of them, but that, hopefully that's a question. But he was. Right. It's all belonged to, well, that was him. As I mentioned briefly, a month or two ago, whatever it was, my personal opinion is that the God of the Old Testament is Messiah from beginning all the way through the end. It's one and the same man, the same character. And that God is the creator, but Messiah is the one who took over, says, you know, hey, shake your hand on day seven, thanks God, you take a rest, I'll take it from here, and takes on and runs forward. Because his creation is finished. So that's Messiah as the caretaker. That's my personal opinion and belief that he's in charge of all of this. Every law, everything they were created, he did it all.
We're always talking about how wrathful God was in the Old Testament.
Oh, how mean he was. How nice he is now. Right. It's one and the same.
He was taught humility.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know how he's taught humility. Yes.
My question was, so every time when the cloud would lift, they would pack it all up. And then they would move where until, and then they would set it all up again.
Yep, that's exactly what it did. Okay. Now, sometimes I believe, I don't recall the chapter off the top of my head, it rattles off how often they'd have to do this. Sometimes the cloud would stay for a day, and sometimes it would stay for a month or a year. So as far as how long it would stay would change, depending on wherever the place happened to be. The question is, if he stays for a day, do they actually build the whole tabernacle? Because by the time they finish building it, it's time to pack it up again. I don't know. I'm not sure. Now, granted, they had a lot of men to help them with. So it may not have taken that long, but I don't know for certain. So hopefully, God was compassionate upon that and let them last. So we'll give you 2 days instead of one and set it up. I'm not sure. Or maybe give a heads up, hey, we're only staying for a few hours. Don't set up. I don't know. But it points out whether it's day, week, or month, or year, they would tear it down and repack it up again and reset it up again. And everything was quick assemble, quick disassemble. The poles described here, which we talked about briefly, the planks, they had poles that traveled through them all. Like a single pole would travel through a whole bunch of planks. So it was a quick assembly process. It didn't take a lot of effort. Well, I shouldn't say effort. It didn't take a lot of time, had a lot of people doing it. I'm a weakling. I probably couldn't pick up a single plank they had. But if he had lots of people, maybe they could. Yes.
So Christ said that to the Pharisees, he said, you look at the Old Testament, you look at the Law of Moses because you think by them that you give you life, that they give you life, but they all point to me. So we're looking at the Torah. We're reading this. I mean, no offense, but you know, it's very dry. And just to read it year after year after year and to kind of try to garner whatever we can garner from it, and then relating that to the fact that now we're the tabernacle, and then also relating that to the fact that when the third temple is going to get built, it's going to be a different temple. But are these things still going to be read? I mean, that this, it's just all kind of nebulous to me. It's just kind of all out there. I'm honestly struggling with falling asleep, and I don't mean to be offensive. So
no.
How did the Lord expect his people to gather what he wanted to gather? When it'd be like me saying to my kids, you know what, kids? Every week I want you to get the blueprints out to the house and how this house was built, and I want you to read them to each other. And that's how you're going to understand me.
That's a good analogy. That's a great analogy. Yeah, it's a good question. Okay, we'll go into it a little bit today. Are there any other questions I can answer? We could jump into this one. If it's related or... Okay.
It is related.
It is related, go ahead.
And basically, if you look at the Hebrew itself, you will find a whole bunch of meaning in there in the Hebrew language that you really don't get in the English translations. So that's one part of it. It's very, very interesting.
Let's jump into why we're covering this. We'll discuss this and maybe for a purpose behind it. It's a common belief. It's a common thought. You're not alone. Yeah. No. Every year, we cover the Torah portion year after year after year, and though it may surprise you, we don't cover the same things every year. So if I cover a Torah portion, meaning I cover a section which I'm reading, and I'll explain whatever it is that I want to talk about that particular day, it will not be what I did the year before. Because there is something different that I leave out every year. I have my list of things. Okay, well, I'll talk about this issue, but not these other five or six, and skip them. So it changes all as years go by. As a result, people change, and faces change. New people come, people leave, they also contribute and add to it. Each synagogue you go to across the same issue. They have the same Torah portion reading, the same words every year, the same conversations every year. It does get very boring. I've been there a couple times. It's a couple years. It was for me. It was boring by the end of by third year. I was tired of it because it was the same conversations. It was quite tedious. But as you learn more about it, you understand why God put them in there. They are not for the sake of studying. That's boring. Doesn't do anything. Reading for the sake of reading? Who does that? You read because you want to learn something, or want to do something, or experience something, or not for the sake of reading. That's what children do. You read so you learn how to read. That's great. That's wonderful. Good for children. They're done. Once they learn how to read, now let's go read stories you like, or something that's interesting. This reading for the sake of reading is boring. There's a lot in here, though, that has nothing to do with what you just read. Which we'll talk about that now. In this section, there are obviously utensils, and there are things, there's furniture, there's obviously different parts and components. Nothing in the Torah, when it comes to the Shavuot Tabernacle or its components, have anything to do with what they look like. It's strictly their function. What they do. A person is defined by what they do. Not what they are, right? If you've done something wrong, you would define what you've done wrong. If you do something right, you define what you did right. If you just have a name, you're nothing. You're just a name. Joe Blow number 7. That's great. Joe Blow, that's your name. When he or she has done something, we say, oh, Joe Blow 7, you've done this. You did that. Now I know who you are. Now I know why you exist. I know something about you. Now we have a definition. Each one of these components has a definition, has a reason why God wanted it in there. The definition has very little to do with what it looks like. There are a few exceptions. The ark is an exception. That is has what it looks like. The rest of them have to do with what they do, what their function is. We'll discuss them today. Mind you, from 35 through 40, most of that is just a re-explanation, rehashing what Moses was already told by God up in the mountain, and each of the times which he went to God to speak went back and forth. God gave me a description of what it looked like, make it look like this, make it look like that, yada, yada, yada. As a result, this is what they're actually building, what the people actually built. Let's get some of the things they built. First of all, when Moses started out, chapter 35, verse 1 through 4, what does he say? What's the first thing he tells them all? He assembles them all together and says, on the 6 days you will work, 7th day you will be holy to the Lord, a day of complete rest to the Lord. Whoever does work on it shall be put to death. You shall not kindle a fire in any of your dwellings on the Sabbath day. Why would Moses start out with that introduction? Any ideas? How many of you have ever met an artist? Oh yes, go ahead.
Just to remind them, there's 1 day a week you don't work on this.
Right. 1 day you don't do this work. Why? Why not? What does it matter? Yes, David.
Well, I find it interesting that, you know, it says Moses started to assemble on the first day of the month.
When they put it up. He puts it up the first day of the month.
Right. So it doesn't go into how long it took that, but let's just assume that they're commanded to work every day. So to construct this the first time, perhaps, and I'm just throwing this out there, could have taken the entire week. And on the 7th day, which is holy and sacred, it's completion, just like creation that he talked about in Genesis. And God resting on the 7th day, they rest after their creation of the tabernacle.
It's possible in the setup time, I don't know how long it took to set up. However, on the creation time, this is multiple months go by. Note, Moses went up the mountain in the first year, on the first time he went up to 40 days when the whole golden calf thing, the massive icky thing that happened there, he comes back down after 40 days. He goes back up again for another 40 days. By the end of all set of 80 days, plus whatever how much time it took him to drink gold, he comes back down and says, here's your list. Get to work. So on that time onward, that's probably around, September, October? Get to work. That time period, you have from that time all the way until the first of the year, which is in late March, early April, to have it completed. So you have that many months set up to actually get all the components done, everything built, and all the tasks completed. During that time period, what's the one day you don't work? Sabbath. If you're inspired to do something, we're human, right? Yeah, it becomes not work anymore, doesn't it? But I have these ideas. I want to go do this because it just stuck in my head. I had to get it out. What's God saying? Temper that. You will have limitations. Temper your inspiration. Whatever vision I give you in God's design for what it's going to look like, when he says that this is what I want you to make, when it comes to Saturday, stop. Rest. Don't make it. Even though you're making it for me. Even though you're doing a godly thing. No, don't do it. Stop. Temper it. Scale it back. Restrain yourselves. So Moses starts his introduction saying, hey, no matter what work you're doing, whether you're working for God or working for anybody else, one day a week, you're going to rest. And it is the seventh day of the week. The remaining 6 days, you'll get the work done. This one, you're going to rest, like it or not. We're starting out, before we give you your mass assignments, this is rule number one. Don't break the rule. Okay? Yes, Deborah.
Okay, it says that question, it says, before the people tried to secure God in their own way, like the golden calf, they tried it their way, and now they would be in his way. God's way resulted in blessings. So they wanted to do it their own way, so maybe that death penalty and all that came because God said, okay, you want to do it your way, you're going to try to secure me with a golden calf and cause me to come to you instead of you waiting and letting me come to you. So I was just trying to think, why would he put a death sentence on that?
Why put a death sentence on it? There is a disregard that happens. When you disregard God, you place him being as less important. So what he asks of you or tells you to do, you've already disregarded him once. It's like a parent who says, child, I asked you to go do this. The child says, okay, mom, dad, whatever it is, and they go do their own thing. What does that make your parent, the parent, think or feel? First of all, I've been disrespected. The child obviously doesn't care for what I asked for, whether it's for their own good or not. It makes the parent feel irritated, upset with the child for not doing the task the child agreed to do. It goes off and does his own thing instead. Well, you're a child too, so am I. So then God says, hey, you will do it this way. And we say, okay, God, sure, and then ignore him. Does he like being ignored? No, he doesn't. So it's important. Now, mind you, death sentence to humans is permanent. Death sentence to God is temporary. So if he says, hey, you have a death sentence for screwing up. No, it's like he can bring you back. God, no, the way God is he can bring you back. So to him, death is not a permanent thing, a permanent state of existence. It's a temporary state. Much of we think of swatting someone's rear end for not doing their job right. It's a temporary pain. Eventually goes away. Well, death's the same way as far as God's concerned. Death is a temporary state. Eventually goes away. Does that make sense? So it's no different than any other punishment as far as he's concerned because he has control over life and death all the time. It's interchangeable to him. Now, I'm not saying he brings people back to life all the time. The point is he can. He chooses to if he needs to. So death sentence is not as permanent as we think it is. Second of all, Shabbat is very important to him. Do you learn anything unless you're listening to God when it comes to him? If you're not listening to him, are you going to learn anything about him? No. If you're busy working, are you listening to him? No, you're not. You're working. Whatever's in your mind, whatever your thoughts are, you're doing that. So you're not listening to him, you're not doing his job, you're not learning anything about him. What good is Shabbat to you? It isn't. It's just another day of the week. His point is, he wants to make sure that you understand this is very important. It's no different than murdering another person. Don't break it. It means something to him, because if you don't do it, you're ignoring your creator, the one who gave you life. Don't ignore him. He doesn't like it much. Yes, Elijah.
why they couldn't have fire on Shabbat was because they had to use fire for the work.
That is true. Now Shabbat on the verse, I think it's verse 3, verse 4, I think it is. Verse 3. There's no fire. What's fire used for? A few things. Cooking. Obviously baking too. And also working. What kind of work were they doing? They're melting metal. You need fire. That's hot. If you're spinning wool or doing the you may not be able to have to melt metal, but the point is you're still working. No fire. We already know from previous readings in the Shabbat, in Exodus as well as, well, actually all in Exodus so far, that Shabbat is a day when it comes to food. You're supposed to prepare your food in advance, before the Saturday. All right? So we already know cooking from previous instructions is done on Friday, also called the preparation day. I'm going to abbreviate for prep day. That you prepare for Shabbat. That's the goal. Working, don't work on Shabbat. So we, the Israelites already know, no fire, so we're not going to be cooking. That's not a problem. We already learned that lesson previously. And there's not working on any of this tabernacle stuff in particular on a Shabbat. So both things are prohibited. You need fire for both items on this instance. Here's a question for you. We're in the middle of winter. Let's say you live in Alaska or northern Canada, and it's cold. What do you do? Let's say your fire went out. Yeah, this is your neighbor. And pray he's really close. There, when it comes to Torah's laws and instructions, there is the explicit words written, and then there's, okay, what does that actually mean? Common sense. If you are cold, and if the fire went out, you're in the dark too, because you're dark. Should you spend your Shabbat in coldness and darkness? No, you shouldn't. That defeats the whole point of a Shabbat. This is the reason where the Judaism gets their rules. Cooking and working fires are prohibited. Heating and staying alive fires are commanded to do so, because if you don't do it, you're dead. What good are you then? Yeah, you don't live. In Judaism, they command, no, Judaism commands it to do so. Not the Torah commands to do it for heat, but Judaism commands it to do so. Because if you freeze to death, you're of no value to anyone. Now, there are Jewish sects who believe and have believed in the past that fire means no fire at all on Shabbat, which means no heat and no light either. Unsurprisingly, most of them are dead. I'll take a wild guess why. Many of them have written down their philosophies and their belief systems. And they have their beliefs and philosophies written down. We still have the piece of paperwork that says so. We don't have a single person who lived through it. Why not? They froze to death. So we know there are some limitations that God must have intended when it comes to fire. When you're freezing to death, is no fire the proper choice? Probably not. Now, if you're not freezing to death, is fire the proper choice? Well, that's your decision. When it comes to cooking and working, those are preset. We know what those are. He already explicitly stated so. He expects us to prepare for our food and not work on Shabbat. When it comes to not dying, yeah, don't die. That's not useful. Too many questions. Go ahead.
About the fire for warmth.
Yeah.
Because that, but if that, okay, you, so what you're saying is that's implied by logic, but it's not explicit in the scripture. So,
it is not explicit in the scripture.
You know?
It is not explicit in the scripture. And that when you use sola scriptura, or the belief of sola scripture, sola, only scripture to understand something with no knowledge as to why or how to apply it, you get yourself into little difficulties at times. There is, on purpose, God did not spell out every detail. And the point of not sending detail out is because he purposely gave authority to certain individuals, in particular Moses, to interpret some understandings. Now, you will note, the Apostle Paul does the same thing. When Paul came up and says, this is my opinion. Now he says, no, I have the Spirit of God in me, so I believe it's a godly opinion, but here's my opinion. So he is taking his knowledge, what God's shown him, say, okay, I'm gathering this together because I'm not a foolish person. I have some wisdom. I'm putting it together and say, this is where I think it actually makes sense and apply it in this way. So he's done so on a spiritual level, what Judaism did on a physical level. The same ideas. Okay, here's the reality of what we instructed, but here's the circumstances we live in. How do we take this and apply it to this? We say, all right, when it comes to heat and survival, get yourself warm, because death isn't useful to anyone. When it comes to cooking and working, you didn't prepare right. Go back to school. Did you do your job correctly? So they've interpreted, just like Apostle Paul interpreted, what made sense with what he understands, given that he has the Spirit of God in him trying to make a proper decision. It's not an easy decision, and there are many who disagree. Say, no, prohibition of fire means prohibition of fire. And that's perfectly fine to stand that, to stand the ground, go right ahead and do so. Is a decision for someone has to make on their own. Yes?
Don't you say don't have a fire because don't kindle a fire?
Don't kindle a fire. You can have a fire that already exists. Go ahead.
Yeah, because that's one of the things that the Messiah addressed in the Sermon on the Mount. When he was challenged a few times on that, and he mentions, you know, about the example that was actually kind of prevalent in rabbinical thought at the time, of the idea of the ox in the ditch.
Right.
Which was basically that falls into the fire for warmth.
Right.
It's like, it's not something that you planned on happening. It's just, it happens, so then right. What do you do with it?
Right.
Do you save life?
Or do you let people die? Now, the intent, of course, is, by all logical accounts, keep your fire going. This only happens when your fire goes out. So if you have a fire set up for Friday afternoon, you have it prepped, great. Keep the coals there. Don't kindle something new, meaning don't purposely set it out. This rekindling is when it accidentally goes out. Oh no, my son dumped his, he spilled his glass of water, fell in the fire, and now it's, you know, nothing but dirt. Oops, what do I do? It was an accident. Fix the accident. So it's not that every week you would do this, that it was, if an accident happens, address the accident. But purposely don't try to do it. Yes?
She say something she's been trying to say.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Ara.
I want you to be good and healthy because I just love someone, because I would decide that I just wanted to do this. Anyone, the money point of my name, of the perfect world, of the Lord, because I miss them.
Yeah. Okay.
That's great.
Interpretation is she's really excited because she loves everybody here.
That's great. We're glad to have you here, too.
Now it's Grandma's turn. I think, for some reason, these two scriptures are coming to mind for me, because my husband loves to say, you know, Jesus came to go deeper and beyond and further expand and bring out, you know.
Flesh out, yeah.
And so I think about the scriptures that say the beginning of the wisdom is to fear the Lord. But then in John it says perfect love casts out fear, because right. Fear has to do with punishment. So you have fear as the beginning, but the exodus of fear, the fear leaving is the end. That's the end goal. Mm-hmm. So you begin your relationship with the Lord by saying, this is Sabbath day. I don't want you to break it on penalty of death.
Right.
Don't cook. Don't work. Make sure you're ready with your fires going. Mm-hmm. But the spirit behind it is, I don't want you to worry about me killing you, because that's not my goal.
The objective is
the goal
death.
Is not to, for me to kill you because right. You've messed up. The goal is I really want you to have a day of rest because I love
exactly.
you.
Exactly, that's the goal.
So it's those purposes. The right. fear of the Lord is to understand His word, understand what it is He's trying to get you, to give you, because He's really always trying to give us something good. And then as we understand that, we then become free of any worry of disappointing
you. You already have a desire to follow it anyway. It's Galatians, the whole son of the promise. When you're an heir to the throne or heir to your inheritance, you already have a desire to do what is good in your best interest anyway. It's already set and you go ahead and do it. Not because out of fear of not doing it, but rather hey, this benefit is worth something to me. I want to continue on because it's beneficial to me. The same idea. Go ahead.
Well, two things. First of all, one of the common mistakes that people that truly don't understand Torah is they look at it as in all the things that they can't do that will cause harm or death, when in fact, the Torah is instructions on how to live and properly followed its life. And Yeshua gives the perfect example with the lady that is brought into the court to be stoned, that she was caught in adulterous affairs, no witnesses, no accuser, that where's the man? And through proper interpretation of Torah, that was a test, she was given life. And that's what Torah truly brings us, is life. Second point, when we look at the things on Shabbat, no fire, no cooking, no working, if you think about living in the wilderness, what it took to cook a meal.
It's a big deal.
Yeah, it's an all-day affair.
Yeah.
Kindling a fire, you know, rubbing two sticks together doesn't happen in 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it could take an hour or more to start with a coal and an ember and kindle that into a fire. So now, between cooking and kindling a fire, you've eaten up your whole Sabbath, and you haven't done anything for resting or partaking in your time with God or listening to what He has to talk to us. A lot of times when we look at these things, you know, we look at it in the Western mindset of how that is in our life. But it truly only makes complete sense when you look at how hard life was. I mean, just to go and gather water or to go to the bathroom. I mean, these things were chores. They're not turn a dial and the gas comes on. We push a button and the toilet flushes. We pull something out and throw it in the microwave. I mean...
That's true. Life is much harder, much more involved in every task.
They had oil lamps.
Yeah. Spread it out that way. Oil lamps, spread the oil. Yeah, they do have a way of doing that, but you have to actually have a fire to start with. Yes.
I just want to also say that, you know, when using common sense, we live in a different century, like he said, too, was Christ kept doing things on the Sabbath. He said it's not unlawful to do good on the Sabbath. And he's trying to teach us that... you know, we can be prepared, especially in this day and hour, and that there's a blessing attached to the Sabbath. But he went around doing good on the Sabbath. So if there's something to be done on the Sabbath, you're right. He doesn't want us to lose life or to obscure people from wanting to come to him. You know, and I believe that it was difficult. And God was, they were in the wilderness, and it was hard, like he said, gathering sticks and doing things like that. But for today, I think that Christ went around because what they had done is they'd taken a law that God created, and they made it hard and burdensome. So where even I know in the church I was in, they made it so difficult that their kids, generation after generation, didn't want to come back because they couldn't put their feet in the water. They couldn't do this. They couldn't do that. So the only God they knew was oppressive. You know, it was like, oh, well, don't do that. Don't you do that on the Sabbath. Don't do this. They weren't, you know, making the day fun and exciting and like, for us now, you know, God reveals so much, I believe, personally, that he reveals so much. We read these over and over, but I believe, you know, your eyes are covered because there's people that didn't know this message before. And I believe that even though it seems menial, year after year, you're like, wow, I never seen that. I never noticed that. I did not know that. And God is, I think he's opening it like a rose and a flower. So when you use agriculture, each year it blooms. And he brings us closer and closer to the throne, you know. And so back then, they were in trouble. They were right out of Egypt. And he had to take them through because of their stiff neck and the hardness. And so, you know, I know that Messiah went around doing all kinds of things on the Sabbath. Not to, we've taken it and made it into, oh, we don't have to have the law at all. We don't need nothing. I mean, like there was something wrong with the law. And so there's just the commentators commentating on something they don't have any knowledge about the culture then. So
all right. We need to get a little further along because there's a lot of stuff I want to cover today. Go ahead.
A couple of questions. Sometimes what's work for somebody is not as pleasure for somebody else. And that's one of my questions. The other was, what about medical people who are taking care of the sick? That's work.
Yeah.
And I had another question, but I forgot it.
That's all right. I might come back to you.
But pushing an elevator button was against the law in Israel,
right,
I know.
Right.
But walking up 4 flights of stairs, that's work.
It is. We're not going to go through every circumstance of what work is or isn't. The point is, when Moses gave this instruction, when it comes to inspiration, and many people have been inspired to do things, whether it be an artist or anything else, comes to inspiration, even though the reason you're doing it is for, quote, godly reasons, that doesn't excuse it that in fact it's still work. And that was the point of this example that Moses starts out. When it comes to tasks that even God said you will build by tabernacle, there are ways which you will do it, and one of them is you will not do it on the seventh day. When it comes to medical examples you just cited, Solomon instituted an exception to this rule of how this process is supposed to work on Shabbats. When Solomon, actually David and Solomon, they did it in cahoots together as David was dying. They said, all right, this is how the Levitical priesthood is going to run. On 3 months or about three months or 4 months, I can't remember, it's three or four, you will have one group of Levites who are not doing the work here, but rather they are doing the defense work, as in they have their swords and their spears, they're ready to work at all times and serve for 3 months. Then when those 3 months are over, they swap sides with somebody else. Another group will come over, they'll take their swords and do the defense work, but the other ones do the work of inside the temple, the tabernacle, the sacrifices, everything else. So what they did on a shift schedule throughout a given year. And Solomon and David instituted that many, many years later. So that concept is not strange or unique. The point is, on Shabbats, they scale it down how many are needed, and we have basically one-third of the body is used for that task, those work tasks that are actually required. Because if you don't defend yourself, as the Maccabees found out, you die. Bad news. So human beings have created scenarios which they can accommodate where they can and still accomplish what must be done. Note, the priests themselves worked every single day. The priest didn't have a Shabbat day of rest. The priest worked 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. Even when they're sleeping, they're still supposed to be working. So priests don't have days off. It's a continuous cycle. The point is, these instructions weren't for the priests on their days off. The instructions were for the people who were building the tabernacle and what their job is. Non-priest jobs. I have a question for you. Does God not answer prayers on Saturdays? Of course he answers prayers on Saturdays. So you can say, Messiah, help me. I'm in this scenario. Don't get out of it. He's going to say, I'm sorry. You have 4 more hours. The sun goes down before I'm going to answer you. No, he doesn't. He answers you now. So God works on Shabbat. We think, well, on the seventh day, it said he rested. Yes, when it's created, but he works every day of the week because we pray. Messiah works and forgives every day of the week because that's what he does. We're praying about it. So they don't have days off, per se, at all. Human beings, the people who are serving in the priest capacity, they don't have days off either. They have things they do differently from day to day to day, but the day doesn't end. God doesn't stop answering prayers on Shabbat. The priests don't start working on Shabbat. There's certain tasks still done, whether you're going to do it or you're supposed to or not. What you do as far as humans is you would take shifts and swap people around periodically. So you actually do have time away to actually do your own thing for a while and have normal Shabbat rest days. That's how human beings created the way of making work around the problem. Does that make sense? Okay. I won't discuss the pushing the elevator button. That's beyond my discussion today. Sorry. Okay. I have other things to cover that are more important than all the Shabbat stuff. So if you got a minute, we'll run through this reasonably quick. I'm not covering all that picture there, but it's a general idea. Okay, deep breath. We can do this. Furniture, lots of furniture, right? All the furniture covered. So we have the ark that was covered. What's the ark? It's the box with the poles and the cherubim top. So let's discuss the ark temporarily. So it is a big box. It has a lid. It has poles. I'll pull it the other way. I'll pretend the poles you're looking at the other direction so you can see what I'm drawing. So I have poles. So I have a box with lid and poles, right? It's gold inside and out. What's in the box?
Ten Commandments.
All right, number 10. What else is in the box? Manna is in the box. What else is in there? The staff. That about it? Shabbat's not in the box. Shabbat's the outside. In the box, in the Ten Commandments, the manna, and the staff. What is the staff? Is the almond staff. Aaron's almond staff. And the men, of course, were the 8th Ten Commandments inside. What's on top of the cover? You have these cherubim. Forgive my drawing. Because I have no clue what a cherub looks like, but I think they have wings. Okay? I'm sorry. I'm not the world's best, you know, drawer, okay? I do it for a living, but not by freehand. They look at each other. They have wings that kind of cover over or cover over on top of. What sits up here above their wings? Nothing. What's above the wings supposed to be? The throne of God. So I'm going to put a big G for God, because in English, God's spelled with a G. So he's up top, up there. That's supposed to be his mercy seat. The box and the cover are all gold, inside and out. It has 10 commandments, the manna, and the staff in the middle of the box. We've discussed this before, those who've been with me a few times. What's the box represent? A human being. This is a man. Yeah. Or a woman, under the point, it's a human being. It's a man. What is in the man's heart? 10 commandments. What is in the man also is the staff. What does the staff represent? It's these things. Eyes. Good job. Eyes. How do I know they're eyes? Because what does the almond look like? An eyeball. It's an eye. What, not only what does it look like, but what's its function? Why does the menorah all have almonds on it? The menorah has almonds. Remember, we discussed this before. Almonds. What do they do? Look, 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 look. It's called the heedless fruit. It heedless because it is one of the first to blossom and the last to actually produce fruit as far as trees are concerned. It opens up early in the wintertime, whether it's pouring rain or not, in the middle of darkness, doesn't care. It keeps the eyes open, the blossoms open up. It stays open and grows all the way to very, 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 very late in the fall season, and finally produces fruit. Almonds are that, it's a heedless or an opening, always looking crop. So inside the man, you have the eyes of God, because mind you, the menorah represents almonds, or almonds menorah is the eyes of God. That's proven in a few verses later. The eyes of God is inside the man. What else is inside the man? Food of God. The angels. Bread of life. So inside the man, which God sits on top of, inside and out. So his inside is just as pure as the outside. That's important to understand. The cherub hang up top, God's on top of it. You got his throne. Inside his heart is the Ten Commandments. Inside of him are the eyes of God looking always continuously. Inside of him is also the angel, the fruit of God, who is sustaining his life. This is an image of a human being. That's what it's designed to be. And who gets to open it up? When God knocks on your door, you got to open it up, right? Who opens you? When God calls you, what do you do? Do you call God, or does he call you? He calls you, right? Well, to open up this lid, what do you have to do? God, move aside, will you? God's got to move. I mean, God has to be the one who actually allows the lid to open, to put all this stuff inside and close it up again. So each one of us, what's God have to do? Open you up, put the stuff inside, and sit back down on top of you. He's above you at all times. The ark is a symbol, one of many symbols of God. It has to do with a few items. The acacia wood itself is obviously all lined on the inside. And the gold is on the inside and out. So it's a big old box that no one else is allowed to touch except God himself, who hangs out on top of it. He's the one who moves. He's the one who opens it. He's the one who closes it. He's the one who stuffs it. He's the one who looks at it and takes care of it at all times. And his angels are covering over it at all times. They're always looking at you. Okay, let's move on. Next furniture item. The table. What's a table? What's it for? Showbread. It's bread. What kind of bread? Showbread, but what does it look like? Is it flat bread or is it puffy bread? Nope. It's puffy bread. Showbread is puffy bread. Puffy bread. Question. God commanded that not a single sacrifice will ever be given with leavened bread. It must only be unleavened bread when you offer any offerings to him. No matter what the holiday is, it's always unleavened bread. But yet on the puffy bread table, He's looking at puffy bread all week long. And there are 12 loaves. What do the 12 loaves represent? 12 tribes of Israel. So what is he looking at through this diagram here? You have the holy place, the table is on this side. This over here is where the lampstand goes, the altar incense is that side. Okay, that's obnoxious. The whole lampstand is supposed to be looking at the table. It's facing at all times. And we already discussed this previously. What's the lamps of God? The menorah. They're the eyes of God. The seven angels of God, seven eyes of God, seven spirits of God. They're always looking at the 12 loaves of bread. And what do they represent? The 12 tribes of Israel. What's God looking at then? He's looking at puffy people. Well, that's strange, isn't it? Because unleavened bread is supposed to be the bread of sincerity and truth. Well, are these puffy people not sincere and not truthful? Oh, what are they puffy with? That's your key. There's a difference. At unleavened bread, which we're coming up with in 2 weeks, days of unleavened bread, I'm going to abbreviate. Unleavened bread, puffy bread represents sin. So puffy bread on these days, puffy bread equals sin. That's representation of it. All your offerings have to be unleavened, which means everything you offer to God is sincere and truthful, not puffy and sinful, okay? So when you offer your offerings, you offer unleavened bread. What's the difference between this puffy bread and this puffy bread? Huge. When this one, what makes this puffy bread here puffy? Sin does. Sin makes it puffy. You're puffed up. The little leaven, leaven's a whole lump. We've seen it. We've read this many times in the New Testament. This puffy bread is different. What fills up this puffy bread? The Spirit of God fills it up. You see, when we go through our holy day cycle, and we go through Passover and days of unleavened bread, we get rid of the sin, get rid of, get rid of, get rid of. At the end of the sin cycle, the unleavened bread, it no longer, unleavened bread doesn't represent sin anymore. It only represents sin during that 1 week period of time. After that, what do you fill it up with? Well, let's think about this. When I expel sin out of my life, what do I want filling it up? Spirit of God in it. Right? So what does the Spirit do? Well, at the 50 days of counting after unleavened bread, we have the 50 days in Shavuot, we have Pentecost, the name for it, which in that day, it's commanded you bring up two really big loaves of bread that are puffy, really big puffy loaves of bread, two of them offered up for God at that day. Well, we already know from the New Testament that at Pentecost or Shavuot, God filled the people up with the Spirit of God and filled them with His Spirit inside them, made them speak in tongues, all that good stuff. So we already have this example. This is the puffy bread for Shavuot represents the Spirit of God filling up people at Shavuot. That means when God's looking at the 12 tribes of puffy bread every week, what's He looking at? Fill the Spirit of God in them, as it is at Shavuot. So the puffy bread for the 12, every day of the week, the 12 loaves are the 12 tribes filled with the Spirit. Yeah, it's He's after. It's his home. He's of course going to fill with His guests, not some stranger's guests. A stranger's guest has sin. His guests don't. So when we, however, offer our offerings, what good are they? When I want to offer an offering to God from me to Him, not from Him to me, what do I have to offer it with? Well, note, I only have sin with me. I don't have God's Spirit to hand out. He does the handing out of that. I don't hand it out. So I'm going to offer something to Him. It can't be with the sin that's with me. I have to get rid of that. So any offering I give to Him, so any offering goes up is unleavened, and then comes down is puffy. Was manna puffy? Ah. They're wafers, like oily wafers. They were fermented. So which means they were puffy. So, bread from heaven comes down is puffy. Bread from ground going up is unleavened. Make sense? We don't want our sins going up to God. We want the good stuff going up to God. And God gives us good stuff coming back down again. Kind of make sense? So, the show bread. What's the table looking at? He's always looking at the puffy bread full of the Spirit of God that He gives. Okay? Next part. Lampstand. We already discussed this 2 weeks ago. We'll discuss it again. I'm changing color because that one's tired. So lampstand, the menorah. We discussed this before. Anybody remember what we discussed? What's the menorah represent? Seven eyes of God, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Seven eyes of God, that's recorded in Zechariah. It's recorded in Revelation as well. They're all seven eyes of God, as far as what its representation of. They're supposed to be watching and looking, and we discussed it before. They are filled with what? What makes them look? What makes them work? What kind of oil is it? It's olive oil, right? Olive. Pure olive oil offered by the people, which we discussed before. What is that representation, spiritually speaking? Work. People's work. So what's God looking at? Your work. If it's good, he uses it. If it's not, what does he do? Revelation, what does it say? He dumps it out. Bowls of wrath. So, depending on what our work is, whether he uses it, whether he doesn't use it, depends on what it happens to be. It's all olive oil, and it's all the eyes of God. So God's eyes are always looking at puffy bread all the time. I need to toggle that thing. So, the menorah itself obviously has little almond blossoms and nubs and everything else. I'm not going to discuss all the details of what it looks like, whether it's straight, round, curved, I don't care. That's the menorah itself. So it's supposed to be the almonds or the eyes are looking at God. So we have the ark, which is supposed to be a man, also known as a throne. We have the table, which is bread, which is puppy, which of course represents spirit, or spirit filled people. The 12 loaves is spirit. We have the menorah, which is the eyes of God. Also, the angels of God is recorded many times. They're one and the same. They're interchangeable. And now we have the gold altar. We discussed this previously as well. What was the gold altar used for? Incense. What is incense? What's it represent? Prayers. How do we know that? Revelation says so. The incense represents the prayers of the saints. So all the gold altar is incense, which is actually prayer. All right, so we understand what these purposes, why we're studying what they are, why God wanted them. So, next question, the offering altar. What's in the offering altar? What's it made from? Do you remember? Bronze or copper, depending on your definition. I don't know how pure their copper would have been, whether they didn't have it mixed up. It looks kind of bronzy when you mix it up with other metals. So let's do this altar offering for offerings. What do we put on it? What's on it? What goes up in the sky? What do we burn? Animals, right? Animals. Animal sacrifices, which include, of course, our unleavened bread. It sometimes depends whether being burned up or not, as well as our hin or drink offering. So the animals and sacrifice, which includes the drink, and sometimes bread. It depends on what the offering happens to be, to whether bread's put on it or not. Sometimes it's eaten, sometimes it's burned up. It kind of varies. Sometimes it's a part of it or the whole thing. All this go in the offering. Why? What does this offering? What does this altar present? Why would God want it? What does it matter? It's where you meet God. It's where many people meet God. So, offerings. We have animals, which of course are cows, sheep, goats, lambs, whatever. What are their jobs? So we have animals that are hola. Spell that correctly. I'll misspell it. Forget it. I'll say burnt offerings. So we know what a burnt offering means? What is that? Completely burned up, all the way up. You don't get to keep it. Why would someone do that? Not sin offering. Sin offering is different. Burnt offering is not the same as sin, the hata offering. What's a burnt offering? What type of offering is it? Do we remember what those are? They're written in Leviticus. We'll read those next week and the week following. It's a free will gift offering. I am giving it to you. So burnt offerings are a gift. Free will. Those offerings we get, we burn up on them. What's the next type of offering? It's a barbecue offering. This barbecue offering, the shaham. I'm going to abbreviate with barbecue because everybody gets to eat it. It's enjoyable. We all like it. This barbecue offering, this is also a gift. But this one, you get to eat it. That's why it's called a barbecue. What kind of offerings go up on it? Sin offerings. Do you get to eat those? No. Who eats them? The priests. Sin offerings are not gifts and not free will. These are priests. I-E-S-T. Thank you. Priest gets to eat them. And what are the penalty offerings? What's between a sin offering and a penalty offering? Anybody know the difference? Ah. So penalty. When you sin and you owe a penalty. So for example, someone who steals, they owe the animal they stole plus on top of that more. Whatever the sin offering beyond, what it's usually 20%, on beyond what they stole. So penalty offerings, or chata offerings, there's other names for them too, I forgot all the names. They are the extra, the ones beyond the actual punishment what you did. See, when we look at it, we think of, oh well, I did something wrong, here I'll pay it back. God says, no, that's not good enough. You did something wrong, you pay it back, don't do it again, here's your penalty on top of it, to remind you how bad this actually was. So it's the extra penalty sense, penalty offerings too. Where do those go? Priests. So, most offerings of holy days, where do they fall on? Barbecues and sin offerings. Most holy day offerings are barbecues and sin offerings. The sin offerings, because you screwed up, or in case you screwed up. And then there's barbecue, let's all eat. Most offerings fall in this category. Burnt offerings, when you offer burnt offering, when God has blessed you so extravagantly, that you're saying, God, thank you. The burnt offering, all gift up, giving up to God, the free will offering in particular, it's the same, but you don't eat it. It's just to hear God, thank you. It's all burnt offering. The barbecue one you get to eat. The sin offering the priest eats. All these are mostly done for holidays. Holidays are typically events. You also have first fruit offerings, which are in the similar category. Most of them get burned up, but some get shared amongst the people, depending on what the fruit happened to be. There's others, but these are the dominant ones we're playing with. So all of these go up on this altar. Why? Why does God want them? Why does he want them? What does it matter? What does it do? Does it do anything? Does it actually accomplish anything? Remind us of something. What do they remind you of? In this list category, when Messiah says he died, by the way, the desert records, when he died, he became our sin offerings, what's recorded, what he became. So Messiah, in this offering, he represents this part of it. The sin offering of these offerings. All right? He also, depending on what the sin happens to be, can represent the penalty one as well. Depends on what your crime happened to be. What does he not represent? These two. Why does he not represent these two offerings?
During the Passover, he said to the apostles, his apostles, take and eat this.
Yeah.
This is my body and this is my blood.
Yep.
It's a sin offering.
Not yet. Not that part. the high priest eats that part, as far as the sin offering itself. He doesn't become a sin offering until he actually dies. All right, so close, but he's like 2 days early, or a day and a half early. Close to it, though. The sin offering itself is actually, you are supposed to die for this, and I am going to die in your place. That's the sin offering itself, what it's supposed to represent. The penalty offering, of course, because you owe more than what you did. The offering which you just described is actually classified in one of these groupings. Because a Passover offering, these are also done at holy days, because everybody gets to eat it. The Passover, everyone's commanded to eat the Passover, whether you're a priest or non-priest. Sin offerings, only the priest gets to eat. And not just the priest's family, but just the priest himself. So that's why he became the sin offering. He would have to eat himself. That's kind of gross. But the barbecue is what he actually, that lamb offering is the barbecue offering classification. We say, well, but it represents the Passover lamb, takes away the sin of the world. Wait, the Passover didn't take your sins away. The lamb itself covered you up. It's a Pesach, which means to cover. So he passes over you. The lamb is a Passover offering, not a pay for your sins offering. What one pays for the sins offering? It's called a goat. When's the goat done? When does the goat happen? Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur, that's your sin. Actually, because the goat represents truly, and it has to put their hands on it. They say their sin, declare what they all are. They slaughter one, they send one off into the wilderness to do whatever it's going to do. To take the sin actually away. Gone, go away. This is where the truly sin offering, which is done for sins in particular. So each of these have their function. This one, no one gets to eat. It's burned up, the goat. But the other sin offerings, they are eaten for your personal sins. So in each of these instances, we have these offerings that God's giving for this animals and sacrifices. He does this one, and he'll do that one too, depending on the circumstances happen to be. This one and this one, Messiah doesn't represent those two items. Meaning, your barbecue gift and your burnt up gift, those aren't the same things as far as Messiah's offer, as far as what his death represented. He represents them in other ways, but his death doesn't represent them. In these particular instances, these are your gifts. What you do. What you offer. When you go to the book of Numbers and discusses the Boker offerings, which is the strength offerings, your young, youthful offerings, that which you were offering up to God, out of your free will and out of your effort, it's what you offer up to him. As in, what do? It's a type of unleavened bread. It's being sincere. Let's pretend for a minute, I'll give you a few examples to help clarify what this means. Let's pretend for a minute, your offering, the thing that you God has blessed you with, your strength, is singing praises to him. You're a great singer. You sing God's songs, whatever, something. That is a gift which you can give, isn't it? So what is your offering then? You would offer him that. It's out of your free will. It's offered to him. Let's pretend your gift is knowledge of something regarding God. And what do you offer it then? Well, on the holidays and Shabbat, amongst people, brethren, what do? You offer what you have. Those are your offerings. They are your free will offerings. They are your gifts given to him. They either get burned up or you share them. Burned up, given up to God, you're praising God, or you share with other people. Those are your offerings. Does that make sense? These are not your prayers, where the incense offer goes. This is not your olive oil of the works you do. This is your offerings you're giving up to him. The altar of offerings is still actively done in every Christian group there ever was. Because as long as you have something you're going to give to God, whether it be your knowledge, whether it be singing, whether it be any gift you have that you wish to share, the Spirit God has given you, you're sharing it. You offer it up. That's the offering process. It's still done today. So the offerings are still given. They're just given in a spiritual form rather than a physical form. This is not the same as these down here, which is, I screwed up. But your screw-ups aren't worth much. That requires God to fix those. You don't bring your screw-ups to church. You don't bring your screw-ups to spread to share to everybody else. That's not what you with it. The spreading of your screw-ups is not the value. You don't offer those up. He has to take care of those. These up here, you do. What can you offer? What do? What's your gift that God has given you? Whatever it may be. That's where offerings land. That makes sense? All goes to him, or one you share. It makes a difference. And what do you offer these with? Always unleavened bread. Which means sincerely and truthfully. Always. As opposed to for personal gain. Personal aggrandizement. For glory. For honor from other people. Saying, oh wow, look at that guy. How great is his singing voice? How great is his this or that other thing? And that's no longer for sincerity. No longer for truthfulness. That's for your self-aggrandizement. There's a difference. Make sense? So we have to make sure whatever we offer is always sincere and truthful. All right? Let's move on. Next furniture item. Wash basin. We discussed before. What's wash basin used for? Washing. What do you wash? Wash people. Wash things. Wash sacrifices. What happens to be? Because what does God want? Clean. Oops. So the E. Now, does he say use soap? No. What does he say to use? Water. What's in the water? Well, one says our water, not our tap water. What else is in the water? Any guesses? Particle of the water. Take a wild stab at it. Let's look at what Solomon did. Solomon built this massively huge pool. He calls it a tub. It's like it's a lake, practically. What's underneath the lake when he builds it? He has little animals. The animals are all massively large cows or cattle. They're bulls. They're carrying the back of this massive bull. Actually, I didn't draw them very properly. They have feet, which are actually holding on to it. Okay, don't be smart, Alec. It's a hoof. All right. So this massive tub of water is carried by the backs of animals. The animals happen to be cattle. Ever hear of the red heifer? Oh, what do you do with red heifer? Ashes? You mix them with water. What do you do with the water then? You put them in a big bucket. Call it a laver, or in this case, Solomon's case, a pool. And what do you use it for? For washing, cleaning, sprinkling. For blessing. So, did he use soap? Sort of. The ashes of the animal mixed with water makes lye water. Is that soap? Kind of, a very weak soap, but it's a soap. So, what's the water used for? Cleaning. And what do they use it? How do they use it? It's with ashes and water. It's mixed together in a big bowl. They wash their bodies, wash their garments, wash their, some sacrifice, not all, inside or not inside, but with this water. They bring it out to, they don't contain the whole water. They take buckets of it out. Solomon, of course, expands this to make, like I said before, very, very, very large. He makes additional, I think it's 10 additional small versions of it too to carry around in his temple. They would change the water at least once a week. The water was redone as far as drained or washed out and redone again at Solomon's time, because there's so many sacrifices, they would use up the water. They had a lot of it. And that's why the temple was built on top of a spring. They could always get fresh water out again. So, the offering altar, where is it? Wash basin. It's for cleanliness. What does God want cleanliness for? Because it's supposed to be clean. Not supposed to be dirty and gross. Who wants dirty, gross things? Ew. So, clean them up. Because when you go before God, what do your hands have to be? Clean. What does that mean? Yeah, what you do matters. What you're offering matters. Is it clean? Is it good? Is it righteous? Or is it dirty, full of filthy rags? What's your goal? Make sure it's clean when you're offering to God and going before God. What you do is good, not bad. Okay, your actions matter. So, the whole point of all this is what you do matters. So, be clean. We have boards, one of my favorite topics, semi-favorite. It's actually an extension of my favorite topic. The wood boards. What are they? What are they made of? Acacia wood. So they're wood with gold all around, wrapped around them. They're about, you know, yay tall, yay wide, yay fat. Okay, that's the size of the board. There's a whole bunch of them. What's their job? Stand up. They stand up at all times. A whole bunch of them, they stand up. I'm not drawing all of them up. There's a whole bunch of boards. They're all around the outside, all around this, along here, the outside along here. There's boards all on the outside of the tabernacle itself. Oh, sorry, the over outer court. As well as also the temple, the holy section as well. They're all boards. Their job is to stand up, because wood / trees stand. What is a tree as far as God's concerned? What does a tree symbolize? Man, what kind of man? an upright man. How do I know that? Ezekiel says so. Messiah said so. They both said the same thing. Trees of righteousness. King David said so. Solomon said so. They say it again and again and again and again and again. Blessed is the man planted by the waters, whose roots extend in the tree, the waters, and the drought comes, and they don't fear. All those good things. Trees represent righteous people, or upright man. That's its job. So what's the upright man supposed to do? Stand up and hold on to this piece of fabric. Lots of fabric. All curtain all around it. Lots of fabric. So the job is to stand up, stand upright. They are wood on the inside, so they are a tree. They're gold on the outside. What's gold mean? Pure. And they're standing. So the outside, they have gold. They also have bronze ones too. The ones the outside here are bronze or copper. The inside here are gold posts or gold trees standing up. They all have this functionality to do their job, to stand upright and be upright. To hold up a curtain. What job is the curtain? What does it do? What do curtains do? What was that? Enclose. They separate. They make a wall between this side and that side. That's what walls do, right? They're all curtains. What are on the curtains? The curtains have four colors, five including gold. They have purple. I don't have enough colors for all of them. There's red and blue. They have blue, L-U-E, and then there's red. I like color markers. They're pretty. What do the colors mean? Remember? Blue is heaven or the sky. So heaven. Nope. I should write the word heaven properly. What is red? Earth, dirt, man. Because they're all the same thing. When God made Adam and Eve, what do you call Adam? Red dirt. That's what Adam means. Red dirt. So, how do we know what red means? It means Adam, which means red dirt. So what does it mean? Red is man. It's pretty simple, right? So man also knows red dirt. He says, you came from dirt, you return to dirt. You stay red. You always be red. And what's purple? The mixture of red and blue? Messiah. Because he is both man and God together. Quite interesting, isn't it? So, all these are mixed together. He has all these three colors, as well as gold and linen. The linen, I don't have a linen example. Well, it's kind of like white, off-white color. All mixed together. What's the job of these planks? Hold the fabric that has that stuff on it. And what's the fabric do? Separate. Separate what is outside versus what is inside. Ezekiel did this for us. He explained it for us already. When he comes along in his example in chapter 40 and 41 and 42 of his book of Ezekiel, it discusses what the outer court and inner court walls are all sprinkled with. They're all decorated with trees and cherubim. Trees on the outer side, cherubim on the inner side. So in Ezekiel's time, he explains these colors in the form of, instead of colors, but in actual things. So he has the trees, the palm trees in particular. Palm trees. He has they're all gold. He has wood as well, because the trees are all engraved on the wood posts. And the palm trees, since we already know trees represent righteous individuals, that's Messiah's, per Messiah's instruction, as well as Ezekiel's instruction, as well as David and Solomon's instructions, we know what those mean. Deborah did the same thing. We know what trees all represent. They're all obviously wood to stand upright to carry up this curtain, designed to separate what is holy and what's unholy. Because what's holy is on the inside, what's unholy stays out. So you have a massive curtain on the top view. You have the bronze ones, the copper ones on the outside. And you have the gold one on the inside. This, the inner court, have a little box here represents the ark. So the gold posts and gold the gold posts, as well as the linen and the turquoise and the blue and or the purple and the red fabric. And the outside you have copper ones with the linen, the purple, the blue, and the red fabric. And you have obviously entrances on the fronts with veils. All of these are designed to represent things. Separate what's out here from what's in there. from what's holy versus what's not holy. What's the first grouping? The first line, the first borderline job? What's his job? It's a courtyard. It's where you get to go, where certain people get to go in certain instances, as far as they need to get inside to talk to or work with God. Do you have an example? The other flip by the little button thing. It shows, let's see here. This picture here. There, that's it. Thank you. So, this is the main courtyard. So you have the copper ones, the outside. The people are allowed in this. Human beings are allowed in this area. Because when you bring your offering to God, let's say you want to bring your sin offering or your this or that or your barbecue offering, whatever it may be, you bring it in here. You don't get to go in here, but you bring it in here. And they wash it, they clean it, they do all the stuff to do it, they burn it all up, all the great stuff. Everything else in here you don't get to see. But this part is where, so this bronze separates your daily life, your outside here, your home, your dwelling place, whatever sins you may do, none of your business, none of my business. They're out here. Don't bring them in here. This is your first separation. For those which you cannot address beyond your skill, beyond your offering, that's a priest's job over here. No one goes in there except one. The high priest. Well, actually, the high priest here. Priests go here. The high priest actually goes there. This little wall curtain thing exists as well. It's high priest this one spot one time a year. The rest of priests can go here. You and your offering stays out here. It's the general courtyard. And of course, these little squares outside represent where the tribes camped outside the camp, the tabernacle. So all this fabric, all this purpose, all this functionality is separate from what is unholy outside versus what is holy on the inside. That's what you want, isn't it? Would God want your uncleanness in his home? No, he doesn't. You have to keep it outside. So we keep it outside. We study these words, this instruction, to know what it looked like, to understand that God wants a separation between what is unholy versus what is holy. And understand the separation, maintain it. Not just physical one, but a spiritual one as well. We have our spiritual separations too, don't we? We want to separate what our spiritual separation is between what is holy and unholy inside of ourselves. Yeah, we want to keep it separate. We want to throw the stuff that's junk out. That's an internal separation we have to build. And what's it built on? Messiah, heaven above, and man. With linen, which is righteousness or cleanliness, we make our own separations inside of our own walls that we have built and designed to build them on purpose to keep God and our sins away from each other. Sins get thrown out, get discarded. We walk in and offer to God, what are we offering? What he wants, what he accepts, what he desires. So we keep these separations. And what does a righteous person do? They stand. They stand strong and hold up that separation. A righteous person says, no, I will be righteous. I will stand here and I will keep my separation from the sins of the world outside to my God who is right here inside. I wish to keep my separation, my righteousness will stand here and I will hold up this curtain. I will hold up this strength for how long I have to hold it up for. As long as I stay righteous and keep the separation between the outside and inside, I want the sins of the world to stay away from my God and my home. Okay? I'm half hour past time. So as far as the roof and the veils, I won't discuss all the details of them. The veils, of course, are mentioned are the walls, the doorways that you walk in and walk around in order to get inside of it. They are decorated similarly to the outer walls, though they have a little more color in them, but not a lot. And the roof is red dyed animal skins. The roof, as far as drapes over the top, I don't have an example if you have a picture of it or not. The roof would drape over this whole thing, on the inside, so you can't see from the inside. Why would you want a roof? Because when birds fly over and they poop, you don't want it landing on the Holy of Holy thing. You have to clean that every time. That's gross. So you have roof that stops the bird poop from landing on your stuff. And also stops somebody standing on the hillside looking inside. Hey, guess what I see, everybody? You don't want that either. So wherever God's at, there's a roof. So you don't get to see the inside either. So it's all covered with the animal skins, which of course are red. And what does red mean? Man, dirt. So covered up. With you and with me. Because what's our job? Again, just like the righteous people standing on the walls, separate what is holy versus what is unholy? Any questions? We study these holy days and these holy things, objects, for spiritual lessons. So what they are, what they mean. So we can use them in our own lives. Understand more about what God did and why He did it. Because why He does something is important to us. That it helps us become good judges, good people, honorable servants. If we can understand why, we as human beings, I'm one of them, say, I'm not going to do that. I'll do my own thing. Why would I want to do that? Because we have to understand the why. It's a thing about human beings. We all want to know why. When we know why, then we do. Well, God didn't tell us why all the time, but He does eventually. The prophets and the instructions, the New Testament, as well as the writings, He explains what these components mean, giving us the why. So once you guys understand the why, we are more than happy to go ahead and do. The nature of human beings. He knows us well. He built us well. He designed it well. I'm out of time. So any questions or comments, anything I didn't answer for you? Any new questions? Yes, Carrie.
Two things. One is, I know we're talking about separation between spirit, you know, clean and unclean, but also I just see that, you know, how we carry the Spirit of God in us, since the boards are righteous men and the curtains are red for man, that's still a picture of the Spirit of God being contained within a person, which, again, that's us. Also, kind of going back to the death penalty for the Sabbath day, there was a thought that caught me was that in the prophetic creation week, the day of rest is also indicative of the millennial reign, the 7,000. If we don't recognize the king as the king during that 1,000 years, we do die.
Yeah.
The second death.
That's true.
So, you know, just like everything in scripture is prophetic, even the penalties are.
That's true. If we can't recognize Shabbat, God said Shabbat would be a permanent marker. That is your identifying mark, much like circumcision, same principle. It's a permanent marker that says if you are on this and you're on the Shabbat, it's yours, you are marked as belonging to God, which means you need to be able to recognize what God looks like. When God comes and does something, recognize who He is and where He is. That's our marker. He says so. So it's a permanent marker forever and ever and ever. So we recognize that value, that important mark, helps us say, okay, when God's doing something, pay attention. I have stood here for years in my life, whether I was living in the 1800s or living in the 1,000 years before Messiah makes a difference. The point is, wherever you're sitting and doing your life, if you have that marker, you know what God looks like, what His task is for you. So when He gives you an assignment, you go do it. As opposed to, God who? God what? God milk? It makes no difference. It's an empty thing. Well, if it's empty, then when God does something and you look up and say, oh, who are you? And God says, yeah, who are you? Go away. You have to recognize Him. And Shabbat and holidays is one of His markers. He points out very explicitly, these are my markers. Don't forget them. That marks who you are and who I am. So you recognize what you're supposed to do when the job comes to do it. Does that make sense? Any other questions or comments? Let's conclude with a prayer. Almighty God, our great Heavenly Father, thank You for this Shabbat, day of rest. Thank You for granting us peace and understanding. Father, help us to learn what is good and right, to understand what You want us to do in our lives. That we listen to Your voice, that we stand as best we can, Father, to separate what is unholy and what is holy. We trust You, Father, and ask You to bless us and help us always stand before You. We ask Your blessing the rest of our Shabbat, the rest of our praise music. In Yeshua's name we pray. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. Hallel.info.